Not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
Coming up on today's show in Profiles in IT, we are going to talk about the father of the video game, Ralph Baer. And we also have a very long list of holiday gift ideas.
And, of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Giant.
Yes.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, let me get this thing on the... Oh.
Oh.
It was huge. Mr. Big Voice, you could have helped me.
Nah, he could. It's a union thing.
It's a union deal, mm-hmm. I know. We got an email from Mary. Dr. Schertz. Mary, if you remember, I got to get, she sent in, she had UMA, and she, which was a voice over IP system, which I highly recommended. She got it. And when she got it at home, it was giving her the voice was breaking up. When she would talk to someone, her voice would be broken up when they would listen to it at the other end. So I said, well, Mary, you better check your upload and download speed. So UMA ran a speed test, and she got 10 megabits upload and 5 megabit download speeds, and she has Fios, no TV, no phone. And actually, those upload and download speeds are actually good enough for voice over IP. There's no problem with those bandwidths. Now, the question is that the bandwidth you actually have when you're encountering the problem? Now, I looked at her speed test, and there was not a latency number. Latency is also an issue. Some people were getting latencies of over 200 milliseconds. If you get latencies more than 100 milliseconds, which would be a tenth of a second, there are 1,000 milliseconds is 1 second, so 100 milliseconds is a tenth of a second. If you've got latency, in other words, packet delays more than a tenth of a second, it does affect voice quality. So I didn't see the latency number there, so that could be the issue. So I went and did a little research. Because I'll tell you, I've also got Verizon Fios, and I got no problem. I got great voice quality. I got the same upload download. I got great voice quality. I set it up a few years ago, and it's never stopped working. Well, I started looking around, and I started looking at the discussion forums, and there are some people who have Verizon Fios that are getting this voice breakup problem. And apparently it has to do with quality of service in the way Verizon treats the packets that are coming through. You see, whenever a packet comes into a router, if time is really important, you give it a high quality of service and you zip it right through. And, you know, if it's like email, doesn't really matter that much. You can give a lower quality of service time and you just delay it a little bit and then the email shows up a second later. But it doesn't matter with email, for instance. So this quality of service was an issue. And so UMA... People complained. I went to the UMA discussion board. So UMA they were actually responding to these comments, and so UMA then was working with Verizon, and they were figuring out which of the upstream servers or upstream points, routing points, were causing this problem, and they were rerouting it, and they solved the problem for a number of those customers, but it really depended on the issue. So I guess I'm just lucky in that I'm not encountering any of those issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now Mary said she had trouble, calling the service desk and getting a support. If you go to the UMA website, there is a live chat button. I'd suggest Mary you go to. First of all, I'd recommend that you go to the discussion forums and put in your particular problem in your zip code, because the service people at UMA, they may not talk to you on the phone, but they are reading those discussion forums. And I think that would be helpful. There's also a live chat button. So that's my advice. I was thinking you didn't have a problem, but maybe there is a problem with this upstream router stuff when I did a little research on it. So why don't you check on that, Mary, and then get back to me and tell me if it worked for you. We got an email from Led by Brain. Dear Dr. Schertz, Now, this is how my main professional Gmail account is set up. She gave me a screenshot because she wanted to make certain that she could keep her email. Some of her Gmails were disappearing. So it turned out she's enabled POP and IMAP, and she's archived deleted emails. And she wants to save all of her emails for at least 18 months. She went over that this was all right. She was configuring her Apple Mail client. She found an article on the Internet that says Gmail sent mail is not safe. Thank you. Actually, Gmail doesn't delete anything, Mary. I mean, I don't know where led by brain. Gmail doesn't delete anything except what's in the deleted folder, the trash folder, and the spam folder. And those, they say for 30 days they don't delete anything. Now, a lot of people will say, oh, I lost an email that I sent. Because what happens is if somebody responds to that email, the entire conversation goes to the inbox. And then it disappears from sent. And then if you decide, oh, I'm just going to delete that response, you need to delete the whole conversation, then you delete also the sent mail.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the disappearing sent mails are because of that. But I don't think actually Google is deleting anything. But she, you know, led by brain, lost some of her emails. The main thing is when you configure it in IMAP, IMAP simply looking at when you configure your Apple Mail client, set it up with IMAP, which is then just going to look at the server, and you can delete it on your local mail client, and it will delete it on the server at the same time, and so they're always synchronized, and you shouldn't actually lose anything. But it looks to me like you've got it set up perfectly. But I didn't see your Apple Mail client set up. I just saw how you configured your Gmail to know whether you've got it completely right. I have to know how you configure your Apple Mail client. We got an email from Duke. Dear Tech Talk, I coach a local sports team. Oh, I guess he's Coach Duke.
Coach
Duke. And all the communication with my team is via Hotmail.
Oh, boy.
Unfortunately, I can't access my email. How do I get into my Hotmail account if I can no longer have access to the phone number that I used when I set up the account or the email that I used when I set up the account several years ago? Thanks, Duke. An Ohio coach.
Uh-oh. He's of the Ohio people.
Oh, I had no idea. We had an Ohio coach up there.
Oh, boy.
Okay, this is the thing with Hotmail. Like when you travel to different countries, Microsoft, because of identity, because people are trying to steal your accounts, if you go to another country and try to log into your Hotmail account, say, from India, they're going to assume that it's some guy trying to hack your account. So even if you do know the password, they're going to ask for a two-factor authentication, so they're going to send a code to your phone. Now, and so if you don't have that phone when you're in India, you won't be able to log on until you get back. They could also send the two-factor authentication if you request to an email account. If you don't have access to the email account, you're gone. And so it turns out that Hotmail in particular had huge problems with accounts being stolen. So Microsoft has really cracked down on it. And it's critical that you maintain your recovery information. So, like, if you change your cell phone number and you don't go into your Hotmail account and put up a new cell phone number, that's a problem. If you change your email accounts and don't update your recovery email accounts in Hotmail, that's a problem. So, Coach Duke, you've been actually failing at maintaining your Hotmail account, and you can't communicate with your team.
Do you think Coach Duke might do better than by getting off of Hotmail and on something that we all use in the 21st century, like Gmail or something?
Yeah, it could be Gmail, but I think he likes Hotmail.
Oh, okay.
And so you've got to update this. Now, if you really don't have access to the phone or to the email, there is a way to recover your email account, but Microsoft makes it extremely difficult. So you've got to go and you've got to put in your name, your birth date, your location. You've got to answer some security questions if you've set some up. They might want to ask you for other passwords that you've used in the past, which is kind of a good indicator that you really have some history of the account. They might ask you for the subject line of any of the emails that you recently sent.
Mm-hmm.
They might ask you for the names of some of the folders that you've created in the account. They might ask you for the email addresses of any contacts which you've recently sent an email to. They might ask you for billing information, including a credit card that you've associated with the account. So the goal is really simple, to have you put down enough ancillary data that somebody else couldn't look up to prove that you're the rightful account holder. So you fill out all this stuff if you've exhausted all of your two-factor authorization methods because you don't have access to them. Then you send that information in. It's not automatic.
Mm-hmm.
A person looks at it, and they decide, or actually Microsoft doesn't say who looks at it, but it takes 30 days for them to make a judgment. And one reason they do that is that also prevents unauthorized attempts to steal your account, because what they do, as soon as this request is made, they'll send out an email and notice to the cell phone number that somebody's trying to reset the password. And if the rightful owner has access to those accounts, they're going to say, wait a minute here, I didn't do that. So the 30-day delay is really meant to protect you. Now, there's one other thing that you could have done, which, Coach Duke, you didn't. You could have set up a recovery password. And what you can do, you can set up a recovery. You can go into your Hotmail account and set up a recovery code. It's like a 25-digit number. You can print it out, and you can put that printed out number in some safe place in your house. And then if, in fact, you have that particular 25-digit number, you can reset your password without all this hullabaloo. But it sounds like, Coach, that you didn't do that. So best of luck. I think if you provide this information, you'll be able to get back your account in 30 days or so. We got an email from Alex. Dear Doc and Jim, I'd like to get in touch with my old college friend. It's been over 15 years, and I'd like to reconnect with her. Where do I start? Thanks, Alex in Reston. Well, Alex, if you'd like to get an email account, email addresses are hard to get. You can if you're lucky, because finding somebody's email address is hard because there's no central database for emails, there's no phone book for emails,
mm-hmm.
And if you have a name, it's not enough because you're going to search for a name, and you're searching the whole world. So
yeah.
There could be 1,000 John Smiths, and you don't know who that is. There could be thousands of people with the same name, and so you got to figure out what it is. Also, you've got all these free email accounts with information that's got nothing to do with the person who you actually are, and so maybe they're kind of masking it. Well, what I do when I'm looking up someone, I go to Google first. I Google them because maybe they've been in the news or something, and you can, you know, if they've got any sort of notorious behavior, it could be showing up on the internet. You never know.
Right.
And so check that first, because she may have a presence on the web. Now, if you have a town where she resided at least one time, that could be useful, because then you can search for that location. You could check Facebook, you could check Yahoo, you could check LinkedIn. Like one time I was looking for somebody I'd worked with at BDM many years ago, and I'll tell you, I couldn't find Chris. This was a fiber optics guy. And I went into LinkedIn, and I finally located him through LinkedIn. But I had his full name, including his middle name, and that was very good for getting him into LinkedIn. I couldn't find him any other way. Now, if you know their employer, you could check a subdirectory. Now, you can also check the online version of the phone book, because all the phone books have online versions. In fact,
yep.
Google used to give phone numbers for people. You'd put in their name, and it would list their phone number. And then everybody complained about it. Now, Google was just taking that phone number from public phone books that are on the web, but then people complained about it, and so now Google started blocking that. And, in fact, if you search for yourself on Google and there's information you don't like there, you can ask Google to stop displaying it. If you want, you can go in there and you can remove that data from your search. These are all things that you can do. And then you can also do the paid search. Now,
that's kind of hit and miss, though, isn't it?
Well, I've used it once, Jim.
And it worked for you?
I used it once. I wanted to track down somebody from college. And so I went there, and I knew where this person had lived
mm-hmm.
I knew where they'd lived one time after college. And I also knew their middle name. So I put in their full name, and I put in this one location. And that was enough to to pin it down. And ultimately, I was able, they were able to, and then, and they gave me a list of names with, and I also knew the approximate birth date because, you know, because they weren't there.
Yeah. Any ancillary information you have will help your search.
Yeah. And so then I was able to pin it down to like four or five, and then I could pick the one that was there. And it, and that, and so then I paid $29, and that search gave me every single address that person had been at.
Wow.
It gave me all their the names of their kids, their name of their spouse. It gave a huge amount of information for $29, and it's, but it would not give me an email address because they didn't want you to use this like to bother somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, if you want us to, we will email them as an intermediary. And so you could write an email, and they would do an intermediary.
And that way, if they want to contact you, then they can get back to you, right?
Yeah, if they want to contact me, they mm-hmm. could get back to me. So I sent an email, but, you know, they didn't want to contact me, so then it just ended. but they did give phone numbers all the way mm-hmm. through at every location. So the paid searches, I actually think, do work, because what the paid searches do, they go through, these are all public records. So they look at the sale of houses,
yep.
purchasing of houses. They look at speeding tickets and anything that's on the – so they basically consolidate all the public records,
mm-hmm.
and then they try to match it up against the parameters that you've gotten. And I'm telling you, most people, you can track them down one way or another because there's so much information available.
You know, if you're cheap – like me. One other thing you could do is when you Google search somebody, of course, you know, not just the name, but, you know, if a city or something will help you narrow it. But mm-hmm. if you Google search images and you find a picture of that person someplace, that might help you.
Yeah.
Oh, because that's the John Smith I'm looking for.
Yeah, you can, mm-hmm. you can do that. So you just put in the name, and then there's a choice up there like says web images.
Right.
So you click on images, you get all the images, and, you know, this is going to be all the images that are on Facebook that they wanted people to forget about.
Mm-hmm.
That Google never forgets about.
Oh, no.
It's always
never,
there.
Never.
Okay, we got,
back to Ohio.
We got an email from Tung in Ohio. Oh, this is the Ohio crew. I don't know what's going on.
Is she having
here.
Hotmail trouble, too?
I don't know. Dear Tech Talk, I'm trying to upgrade my iPhone to iOS 8.1 and can't because I don't have enough memory. I deleted all my pictures after copying them to the to my laptop. I don't know. That would, you'd figure that.
This is another problem.
You'd figure they'd have too many pictures on their iPhone. And I still don't have enough memory. What are my options? Thanks, Tung in Ohio. Well, Tung, this is a problem, actually, because iOS 8 takes a boatload of memory.
Mm-hmm.
And so, first of all, if you can't do it, it's hard to do an air upgrade because it takes so much memory. So most people want to hook it to their laptop and then do the upgrade through iTunes. So your laptop downgrades the operating system. It unpacks it, and then it just simply transfers it to the iPhone. And you need less memory in your iPhone to make that happen. Now, one reason that it's hard to clear your memory in the iPhone, I want to explain what happens. You've got the pictures that you took, and that's in your pictures. And you've got your what do they call that? The camera roll.
Right.
You've got the camera roll. It has all the pictures. So you delete all the pictures from the camera roll. Well, it turns out that the operating system also has deleted pictures. So then it goes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So they're still saved on your iPhone. They just move to deleted, and they sit there for 30 days. So you have to delete them from there.
Didn't even know that existed.
In addition, you could delete all of those and all those things, and you'd still have maybe three megabytes of pictures. All the pictures that are in PhotoStream are also stored on your phone.
Mm.
So just deleting the pictures in the camera roll typically doesn't help you because then it just go to deleted. Now,
yep.
you could go to deleted and delete those if you wanted to, but then you'd still have all the PhotoStream stuff. So mm-hmm. then you've got to delete the PhotoStream, or you've got to disable PhotoStream in order to really free up memory. Now, the other way to free up memory is that, so what I did, I deleted all my pictures, but I didn't want to undo my PhotoStream because then I liked having the PhotoStream backup. So I left
sure.
it there, and I still didn't have enough memory. So then I unsynchronized all my music, and then it deleted all the music from my iPhone, but it left it on my laptop. Then I was able to go through the process and upgrade. So it sounds like that Thung in Ohio has some picture problem and some photo stream problem.
I think Thung has had other picture problems she's alluded to in the past.
Yeah, I know. So that's it. Now, I would recommend that you don't give out the password to your iCloud account, because all your photo stream pictures are going to be on iCloud, and that could be a problem.
Yes.
We got an email from Alice in Washington. Dear Doc and Jim, I use Gmail for all my business activities, and I'm worried that I have no backup. What's the best way to back up my Gmail account? Well, this is actually an interesting thing, because a lot of people use Gmail or Hotmail for everything, and then if it's gone, it's gone. So one easy way to back up your Gmail account is to enable POP3, Post Office Protocol 3, because what that does, so you could have one computer, one desktop, and you could have a mail program like Apple Mail, or you could have like Microsoft Live Mail or Thunderbird. There are a lot of mail clients. And then you can basically set it up, set that client up to talk to your email account using the Post Office Protocol. But when you set that up, be very careful when you go into the configuration and click something that says, click on this option that says leave the messages on the server. Because if you don't do that, as soon as it downloads them to your local mail client, it will delete them from the server.
Mm-hmm.
So then what you can do is you can simply download the email, and it will synchronize with the server, and the Post Office Protocol will just download all the email right to your local client. And so then your local client serves as kind of a backup of the Gmail. So that would be a simple way to do it. I mean, you could export the thing, go through it, but this is just have one particular laptop or desktop, and you just periodically go in and just synchronize it, and it will just download everything. It'll still leave all your mail there because you've told it to. It just downloads everything. Now, the first time you do this, it might take kind of a while because it's going to download all the
right
pictures, but that would be a way to back it up.
There you go.
So that was a great thing. We love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll either email you back or we'll cover it on the show.
And the show is called Tech Talk Radio, heard every Saturday here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by. More Tech Talk coming up in just a minute.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, and today we're going to feature Ralph H. Bearer. He was suggested by James Messick last week. It was a great suggestion. Ralph Bearer is a video game pioneer, otherwise known as the father of video games.
You have lots of fathers of on
yes,
the show.
Yes, we certainly do. We have many fathers of so many things. Not very many mothers, mostly just fathers.
Exactly, except we did have Grace Hopper.
We did.
She was.
Yes. That's right, we did. That is very true. Ralph Baer was born March 8th, 1922, in Pirmasens, Germany, to Jewish parents when he was 11. It's a bad time to be in Germany, by
the
way.
It was, yes.
When he was 11, he was expelled from school in Germany because of his Jewish ancestry, and he had to go to an all-Jewish school. 2 months before the Kristallnacht attacks on Jewish stores and homes, the Bears fled to Holland and then the United States. And the relatives that were left were killed. Mm. And they just escaped before the crackdown. In 1940, he completed the National Radio, a correspondence course from the National Radio Institute. So he learned a little bit of electronics. He was basically self-taught. And then for the next 3 years, he ran a store in New York City servicing and repairing not just radios, but PA systems and early television sets as well. He earned a whopping $12 an hour.
Back then, that was a lot of money.
That wasn't bad. Back then, that was probably a pretty good salary.
Sure.
In 1943, he was drafted to fight in World War II. Because he was so smart, he was assigned to military intelligence, and he was then further assigned to be in Eisenhower's headquarters in London. He wrote training manuals and became an expert on German weapons, so he got all of the German weapons, learned how to use them, and then he would train U.S. personnel on how to use German weapons in the event that's all they had.
Sure.
And so they'd know how to use it. After the war, Baer graduated from the television engine, got a Bachelor's of Science in Television Engineering from the American Television Institute of Technology in Chicago. That would be in 1949 after the war.
Who knew that there was that and the National Radio Institute?
Yeah.
We should go to that, Doc. Maybe we could learn a few things.
We should try to check
better.
That out. And, back in 1949, a degree in television engineering was a rare commodity.
I bet. There weren't too many TV stations back then.
No, very few TV stations. That was like a technology yet to come.
Mm-hmm.
In 1949, Baer went to work for Wappler Incorporated, where he designed and built surgical cutting machines, epilators. What's an epilator? Does that like trim your skin or something?
It must be. Let me check.
Check on
that
because we need to, we got to have all the technicals.
We need to know.
Epilators as well as low frequency
of the airwaves.
As well as low frequency pulse muscle toning equipment. You put these things on and they contract your muscles for weight loss. Kind of gimmicky, but he designed those. In 1951, Baer went to work as a senior engineer for Loral Electronics in the Bronx, New York, where he designed power line carrier signaling equipment for IBM, where they could send signals over power lines. From 1952 to 1956, he worked at Transitron, Incorporated in New York City, as a chief engineer and later as vice president. Then finally, in 1956, he got his official home, and he joined Sanders Associates, where he stayed until he retired in 1987. Sanders eventually was purchased by BAE,
mm-hmm.
which is really a big defense conglomerate now. While he was at Sanders Associates, he worked on alphanumeric projection displays for the better part of the 60s. And in 1966, he came up with the original concept for playing games using a home TV. This was the big thing, mm-hmm. and based on he actually had sort of handwritten notes when he sort of came up with the idea, and those became the sort of the basis of the patent of the first video game. He designed, while he was there, what he called the Brown Box console video game. Now, that's not a very good name for marketing.
No, it's not.
The Brown Box. Probably he just put it together. He probably just had a brown box and he crammed all the electronics in a brown box. They ended up licensing this video game technology to Magnavox in 1972. He applied for the first patent for video games in 1968. So in 66 he invented it. In 68 he applied for the patent. developed the Brown Box, and then in 72 they licensed it to Magnavox. Now, the Brown Box at Magnavox was renamed the Magnavox Odyssey.
It's a better name.
Yeah. And the game that really was a hot ticket on the Odyssey was Pong.
I had that.
You remember Pong?
Yeah.
I played Pong before.
Yeah,
you just
sure.
hit the dot back and forth and move the two paddles up and down. It's, it's
pretty rudimentary.
That was really the first game. Now, Bear was responsible also for first-person shooter games, which featured a light gun. And so what would happen, this light gun, you would point it at the TV, and it would actually pick up the modulation from the TV itself to tell what you were pointing at.
Oh.
It could tell from the phase of the modulation of the scanning signal where you were pointing it. And so it got feedback from the screen. I think the light that was pointed there had nothing to do with how they detected the location, as mm-hmm. how the person did. So he invented the light gun, and that was the first video game, peripheral device that was developed. In the mid-70s, he started the R.H. Bear Consultants Group. Well, this was while he was still working for Sanders, actually. And while he was at that group, he invented and developed the single-chip microprocessor-controlled handheld game system. So it was getting smaller and smaller, as technology was being developed.
Sure.
And he developed that for Marvin Glass and Associates. Now, for that particular microchip-controlled handheld game system, he and his partner developed a game called Simon, which was an electronic game based on memory skill named after Simon Says.
Mm-hmm.
And what they would do, they would have like four different colored squares, and they would pop up in different order of different colors, and you would have to remember what you just saw and reproduce it. Simon Says. So it was kind of a memory game. Bear has 150 U.S. and foreign patents, a significant amount of them resulting in toys and games that eventually went into production. In 2006, Bear donated all of his hardware prototypes and documents to the Smithsonian.
Wow.
So I'm waiting for that big display to
That'd
come out.
Cool.
I haven't seen that at the Smithsonian yet. Bear is a life senior member of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. In February 13, 2006, Bear was given the National Medal of Honor by George W. Bush. In April 1, 2010, he was inducted into the Inventors Hall of Fame. So there's the man, Ralph H. Bear, the father of the video game. These were very rudimentary games, but he came up with the basic concept back in 1966.
That's pretty funny. You talk about the Brown Box. Back
yes.
then, I mean, all of the electronics components and they were very industrial looking. Now everything looks cool.
Yeah.
Back then it was all
just a
box of parts.
That's
basically.
Right.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, which is, of course, a classroom of the airwaves. And I hope you're paying attention, because we will be playing the pop quiz in just a minute. Here on Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by. We'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's this guy right here.
And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Ross. I'm the adjunct professor for messing things up and for lowering the academic bar here on the Classroom of the Airwaves Tech Talk Radio. We just finished talking about Ralph Baer, renowned as the father of the video game. In 1940, Baer completed a correspondence course at the National Radio Institute. And this led to a job doing what? If you know the answer to that question, you can now parlay your knowledge into a fabulous prize. Free tickets for dining for two at the Escoffier Stratford University on the campus in Falls Church or at Cafe Karim on the campus in Woodbridge. But you've got to get that answer to me now by calling these following 10 digits in the proper order. If you're calling from west of London, England, it's 877-936-9333. From east of Bronx, New York, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line, 877-936-9333, the pop quiz on Tech Talk Radio.
The question is, with snowflakes, are two snowflakes ever alike? Now, there was a guy by the name of Wilson Snowflake Bentley who took over 6,000 photographs of individual snowflakes between the early 1880s and until his death in 1931. No two snowflakes were alike in his entire 50 years of research.
Well, at least he put his life to good use.
Now, snowflakes tend to have a six-sided geometry, and that comes from the hexagonal lattice structure of the ice molecule, which has six-sided symmetry. So most snowflakes have some sort of six-sided symmetry as they grow. But the fact is, it is true that no two snowflakes are alike. I should say no two complex snowflakes are alike. If you have a very small snowflake, maybe just made up of 10 water molecules, it would be very simple. There might be some of those that are the same. But if you get a large complex snowflake, no two are alike. Now, here's how we can analyze it. First of all, you've got three variations that occur within snowflakes. You've got variations in isotopes that can be distributed throughout the snowflake, and I'll explain that a little bit further. You've got variations in stacking faults, and then you've got variations in growth dynamics. Now, it turns out that isotopes are like you can get atoms, stable atoms of a different weight, like, say, oxygen. Water is made up of oxygen, two oxygens and one oxygen and two hydrogen, H2O. And occasionally you'll get heavy water, deuterium, which is an isotope of hydrogen, and it's basically double the weight. It has an extra neutron in the nucleus, so it's atomic weight of 2 instead of 1, which is what hydrogen is. And those are distributed about one molecule out of every 5,000 molecules that actually is deuterium. So the deuterium molecules could be distributed randomly throughout the snowflake, you see, and there are a lot of ways that could be done. In addition, am I hearing music that's coming up?
I'm trying to play Winter Wonderland piece that you're talking about snowflakes.
Now, in addition, there's also an isotope of oxygen that occurs quite often. It has an atomic weight of 18 instead of the normal atomic weight of 16. So if you take all these variations that you would have just in isotopes, it's unlikely that the isotope distribution for any two snowflakes would be the same. I mean, so just from an atomic level, they probably wouldn't be different, or they would be different. And so that's the first variation that probably wouldn't see very often. Now, the second variation would be in stacking faults. When a crystal grows, the molecules don't stack together perfectly. You get stacking faults, they could be distributed. And you could argue that no two snowflakes could be alike because the stacking faults would be variable. And the third variation is that there are growth dynamics. As the snowflake is falling, it's encountering different dust particles, different air, encounters with the wind, and it grows in a slightly different way because each snowflake takes a different path. So if you take all of these three
factors together. Someone did a calculation, and they calculated that there are more variations on the way that a complex snowflake could grow than there are atoms in the universe.
Does temperature play any role in this? In addition, if it's very close to freezing or if it's really cold?
Yeah, temperatures do a... If you've got very colder temperatures, the ice crystal tips are sharper.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a sharper looking...
those are the snowflakes that hurt when they hit you in the face.
Yeah, that's
right.
If they're big. I mean, and they're... Now, at warmer temperatures, the snowflakes grow slower, more rounder. They have less intricate shapes. So temperature does make a difference. There have been, by the way, the largest snowflake that ever fell was in Siberia, and it was almost 8 inches in diameter.
Now, that would hurt.
Now, I've never seen that, but there you go. So that is the question.
That's more like a meteor than a snowflake,
yeah,
right?
Pretty much.
Okay,
meteor.
So Tech Talk can answer the question, every snowflake is unique.
Let's talk about Christmas gifts now. We've got 20 minutes here. Okay, so this is a very selective list. These are all things that I like.
Of course.
Now, you know, I have the Philips Hue lighting all over the house. You know, these
because
LED lights
special.
All over the house.
Yes.
I've got 50 of these Philips Hue light bulbs. I went berserk over these things. I love them. I can change the colors anywhere in the house. The trouble with the Philips Hue bulb is that every bulb is $60.
That's right, yes.
So they're expensive. Well, and they'll change. You can adjust the color to anything you want. Well, Philips came out with the Philips Lux Starter Kit. Now, the Philips Lux bulbs, you can't change the color. They just have a nice sort of white glow.
Mm-hmm.
And they're single color. They look like kind of a regular light bulb, and you can dim them at your want. But the nice thing is they're only $30. So,
well, it's so much more affordable.
Well, it's a lot better than $60.
Yes, it
but
is.
See, the thing is, it looks like a 60-watt bulb, but it only uses 5 watts. And the light bulb is good for 10,000 hours. So I'm not going to have to change the light bulb for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, probably the return on investment is a good long while, but I like the fact that now you can get Philips Lux, and now they're only $30 a bulb. They also have the Philips Hue Tap. This is I got these out of order. The Philips Hue Tap.
Thanks.
See, one of the issues with the Philips Hue light bulbs, I control them with my iPhone.
Right.
And I've got an application that's always connected. Well, there are other people in the house. They can never quite get their iPhone connected up properly, and so it becomes...
We're not naming names here.
No. And it's always an issue. It's always an issue because now I've got this great lighting system, but now it's like that you have to go to IT support to get the, you know,
and
get
your
it working.
IT support.
Yeah. So the Philips Hue Tap is actually a switch that you can put in the room, and you punch the button, and you can adjust it just by pushing a button. And so you don't have to have your cell phone there at all.
So tapping it.
You tap it, and it's got 4 buttons to turn it on and off, and you got a couple of other buttons to pick what color you want.
Okay.
So with the Philips Hue Tap, you know, this allows for people that are not, say, tech savvy to just use it more like a light bulb. Now, the Philips Hue Tap, it's $60 for this particular switch.
You're bleeding me dry just putting light bulbs
but
in
see,
here.
But see, that solves a particular problem for me, which is why
this is
why it's on the list, yeah. Now, the Logic Harmony Ultimate Home Remote. I like this because, first of all, this remote will not only, you know, can be used to operate your Harmony TV system, but it'll also talk to the Hue light bulbs. So I can control my Hue light bulbs with this, and it will connect to apps in your iOS system, your iPhone or your Android, and you can use it to talk to, say, a Nest thermostat. You can use it to talk to a home entertainment system. So this is probably a universal remote for all of your home activities because everything sort of talks with a standardized wireless protocol. And that particular remote, for those of you that want to get all of this nice stuff done, you can do it. And like a Nest thermostat.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Nest came out with this learning thermostat. You know how you program your thermostat, to go down at night, you know, get this complicated schedule?
No, I just leave it at 71 degrees.
So that's the same with me. It's just too complicated to sit there. I mean, I suppose I could get this 20-page book and I could program my thermostat, but, you know, I don't do it. It turns out what the Nest does, it remembers what you do. So you turn it down, turn it up. It remembers it.
And then it can detect when you're in the house or not because you're walking around. And it adjusts the heat on your itself. So, like, suppose you're not in the house. It doesn't detect you walking around. It might lower the temperature. It knows you're going to come back at 5 o'clock. It raises the temperature, and so the Nest thermostat actually saves a lot of money. It's around $200. Get this: the Harmony Ultimate Home Remote will talk to the Nest.
No kidding.
Yeah. So you see, everything is now
everything
unified.
Is connected to everything.
This is my kind of list. Now, if you want to also have a drop cam Wi-Fi video monitoring system.
And why not?
Why not? That's Nest also sells that. And that's between $99 and $199. And you can get all sorts of video there. You can upload it to the cloud. It connects to the same Logitech Harmony remote control. So everything is unified together through Wi-Fi. And then the ultimate... the August Smart Lock, connecting also to the Wi-Fi. Now, the nice thing with this Smart Lock, it uses the same deadbolt and everything, and you can use the same hole that's drilled in your door, and you just slip it in, and it will basically, it's a motor that will turn the lock on its own. It got great reviews. It's a little pricey, $250 to $500, but it has a Bluetooth enabled, so you can have an app in your phone, and as you walk up to the front door, it'll unlock.
Automatically. Or do you have to push?
No, automatically, because it'll sense that you're there.
Wow.
You can also suppose you can send a key to somebody to their phone, and when they walk up, it will unlock.
So what if you forgot, maybe you left the house, you're driving down the street, I forgot to lock the door. Can you do that remotely with this thing?
It will when you leave the house, it automatically locks.
So no more forgetting to lock up.
Yeah. So the only problem is if you leave without your cell phone,
then you got a problem.
No, but you do have a key option
right.
in the event.
Okay.
So like suppose you've got a party tomorrow night.
I don't, but go ahead.
But just say you were inviting 100 people.
Okay.
It would be a major blast.
Yes.
You could send a key to all 100 people invited to your party that was good for a 2-hour time block. So only good for that 2-hour time block. They come to the front door, it unlocks, and they can come in. So you don't have to be running back. You know, if somebody comes there, you leave the bar and have to go to the front door and open it. It will automatically unlock for you.
That's pretty neat.
Or suppose you've got the cleaning lady who's coming Tuesday at 11 o'clock. You could leave a time window open for them, give it to them, and then you can restrict it. So it's actually a very good way to manage access to the house instead of giving out keys.
Could you, get your dog a cell phone with a lock on it so he can let himself in and out of the apartment?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, you could, well, you'd have to, you know, hook the cell. That's probably a possible option, yeah. They don't have that feature yet unless you strap a cell phone to your dog's collar.
See, there you go. I mean, I'm trying to teach my dog to take care of himself.
So there you go. This is sort of all the things that are on my little wish list. You can see this, yeah.
Yeah, I see.
That's right.
Okay, so you have other ideas here too, right?
Yeah, so let's look at some other tech gifts that, you know, Bluetooth speakers are really, you know.
Aren't they really, yeah.
They're nice to have. So the one that I have is the Bose SoundLink speaker.
And that is amazing.
It's $200. I love that.
And it's worth every penny of it.
I love the Bose Bluetooth SoundLink speaker. I've had it about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the battery lasts a long time. It's got fantastic sound.
Plus, you can leave it in if you wanted to. You can leave it in the cradle
Leave it in the cradle, and it's always charged up. Now, if you don't want to spend $200, the JBL Jawbone Jambox Bluetooth speaker is less than $100. And that has gotten great, great reviews. It's, you know, people say the sound is really good. Some people, though, just want to have like a smaller Bluetooth speaker that go around with them. So the Jam Classic Bluetooth wireless speaker for $20. So, you know, you're a teenager in the house, or one of the kids wants to take a Bluetooth speaker with them. There's one for only $20, and it's got pretty good sound. It's wireless. Now, in terms of headsets, now the one that I love.
And the one that you have, right?
And the one that I have. Have you noticed this list is all about me?
Well, you know what? I'm checking off what you have so I know what not to get you for Christmas.
So this list is all about me. That's terrible. Bose Quiet Comfort Noise Cancellation Headphones are around $300. I love these, especially when I'm flying on an airplane, because it cancels out that airplane background noise.
Like screaming people and
crying babies.
Right.
And so I can be on a plane and I'm just happy. Now, if you now, of course, the newest entree to the headphone area are the Beats.
The Dr. Dre Beats.
The Dr. Dre Beats, and they've got the studio wireless headphones. You see, the thing with the Bose, it's not wireless. You got to plug it in.
Right.
So the Beats are saying, well, we're now Wi-Fi or Bluetooth wireless, so you don't need a wire. So you can, but those headphones, the wireless headphones, are between $300 and $600.
I'm thinking,
I'm not going to spend $600 on a headset.
When I bought my headphones that I'm wearing now, I looked at some of the Dr. Dre's. They're too clunky. I don't like clunky headphones.
Yeah, I don't like them. But they have these nice. They're designed, I think, probably to appeal to somebody in a different age bracket than me. With the
Reed Younger.
That's right. So I think the Bose might be for the old fogies. I don't know, but the, you know, like
no,
I would,
no,
I would,
no. Audio aficionados, I
audio
would say. Yes.
See, like, I would never get red, a red headphone.
And no, that, and that's, no, that would not be you.
And that's one of the...
You'd get Stratford Blue.
That's, I'd get Stratford Blue. Now, if you don't want to spend that much money, the Audio Technica ATH-M30 headset has got great reviews and great sound. It's not noise cancellation, but it's only $60.
And they're not wireless, right?
They're not wireless.
Okay.
But it's $60, so if you want to give a good quality headset to someone, you don't want to spend...
$300, $600.
You can get that one for under $60. Now, the other big thing this year are these media streaming options, you know, where you plug something into your HDMI port in your TV and you can stream stuff directly to it through Wi-Fi. Now, number one on the list, Google Chromecast I have. That's $35, but currently Amazon's selling it for... Amazon's currently selling it for $23.
Really?
Yeah, and you can only buy one. There's a limit. There's a limit of one at $23. But what I discovered was, I wait because I needed to order three. I'm giving these as gifts. So I waited 24 hours and I ordered a second one.
So one every 24 hours.
So then. I think it's one every 24 hours. So I'm doing research on that. So Google Chromecast allows you to basically mirror, like if you've got an iPad or an iPhone or you've got a Chrome browser open, you can basically send that screen to the TV. And so you operate Google Chromecast without a remote or anything. So I use it to, you know, I'll bring up Netflix on my iPhone or my iPad and I'll send it to the TV and I can watch Netflix. So I got one TV without internet connection on it, but I use the Google Chromecast. Now, Apple TV's been around for a while. Now, that has a remote control on it, and you can use that for streaming media. So a lot of people that have Macs and the Mac infrastructure, you can display all your pictures on your Mac. You can have slideshows. So they've got a great ecosystem if you're 100% Mac guy. But that's $99, and it also has Netflix and everything else. But they don't have as many media options as the other ones. We've got Roku Streaming, R-O-K-U. That's from $40 to $100. They've got the best content. There's no mirroring like Google Chromecast. They have remote control. They also support an app. They support either an iPhone app or an Android app, so you can control the Roku through the app. And a lot of people say the Roku is the best because it's got the best app options, but that's if you want to deal with a remote. And then the last entree to the thing was the Amazon Fire. That's $40. It's got limited content now. Their app only supports the Android, and you've got a remote control. And so that probably you might want to wait a year before you get the Amazon Fire. So those are one of the big things that are coming along the board now.
Gotcha. You have more, don't you?
I got a lot.
Just keep going. Just keep. I think we. Let's just keep. Let's run
let's
out
just,
the hour.
Let's just keep let's, on running.
Because I still don't know what to get you. And
okay, this
because
you know. This is all about me. So just
right.
So just be taking notes over there.
I am.
Okay, now I think an external USB hard drive is a great gift for people. You can get a 2 terabyte USB external hard drive for less than $100. You can get a 1 terabyte hard drive for $60. There are a lot of people out there that take all these digital photos and they don't store them.
Right.
They're all over the place. So what you do is you give them this external hard drive gift, and along with the gift, you say, "Look, I'll help you organize your pictures. I'll put them in folders for you. I'll help." Because there are a lot of like people in the older generation, not like you know, not
us.
The, not
us.
No, older than us.
Yes.
Who who really might need help organizing their digital photos. And so this could be really a great gift. Now remember, just putting them on the hard drive, if you delete them from the computer, there's no backup. A backup means they're stored two places, not
right.
just one. So I have the Toshiba. You can get Toshiba, Seagate, Western Digital. I have Toshiba. It got great reviews. And I've got a 1 terabyte Toshiba, which I bought it for $100. Now it's only $60. But that is a great gift for many people. Then, of course, the big item out now, the fitness trackers. So, you know, because now the new iPhone app has that health application. What do they call it? They've got the heart on it.
It's
called Health. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
It's got the Health app. And that will connect all kinds of devices. And there are so many out there now. I just put down three. The Garmin VivoSmart. That got great reviews. That's $169. Now, the VivoSmart brings together activity tracking of the fitness band and the notifications of a smartwatch. So it's got two things. It's got notification and tracking. So it sort of knows about what you're up to. For instance, it will track your calories, your sleep, your steps. And then it will vibrate to remind you that it says, hey, you haven't. Why don't you move again? You've got to move. And so it sort of keeps you going in case you've been sitting at your desk for too long. It's kind of a great combination. And that's $169. Move, M-O-O-V, got great reviews. It's $79. Move isn't like a traditional fitness tracker that merely tracks steps, calories, and sleep. Move's 3D sensors and Siri-like voice coach can guide you through running, walking, and boxing workouts, making certain that you move correctly to get the most out of your exercise. It's sort of like a coach. Move. Now, the Fitbit Flex has been around. Fitbit's been around for a while. Flex works with either Android or iPhone. Bluetooth compatible means you don't have to upload your data transfers. And it will track your sleep and your steps and all of that sort of stuff. And if you can upgrade it to the Fitbit Force if you want a full screen, which doubles as a watch. So those are all fitness trackers. And kind of the last category were laptops.
Right.
Okay. I think the Apple MacBook Air, the 13 inch, is a great device. That is a great device. The 11 inch MacBook Air, I think the screen's a little bit small, but that 13 inch MacBook Air, it's light. It's really nice. It's less than $1,000. I was looking on the web today, I saw one for $880. It's a great price. Now you can get the Acer Aspire Switch 10. Now this is what they call a hybrid. It's where the keyboard clips off and it's a touch screen. Mm-hmm. It can be a tablet or a laptop. That actually, it's got a very good magnetic detachable system. It's one of the hybrids. It's a nice unit. It's only $320. Now, the Acer Chromebook 13, this is basically, this basically uses online applications. And so it's basically uses Google Apps, all the Google products for online operation. Now, it actually replaces the normal x86 Intel CPU with an ARM-based CPU from NVIDIA, and it's got a very great 13-inch high-definition screen and great graphics. The final one would be HP Stream. That by the way, that was Chromebook's only $350. The HP Stream's a low-end device, which only costs $200, and it'll actually act like a Chromebook, or it will also operate with Windows. So it's kind of the rundown of the gifts today. Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu and make certain to go to the Stratford University website at stratford.edu and tell them that you heard about them on Tech Talk Radio.
See you next week on Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.